welcome everyone. Let me quickly say a couple of words about first Michael Jacobson. He's a professor and chair of education. As I noticed today only was that there is an addition to this title that he's also professor of social work. I just noticed that connection to the...
Well, our faculty has got social work in there, but don't ask me about helping people.
Okay. So he held different professorships and faculty positions, for example, at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. He was at Vanderbilt University and at NIE in Singapore, among a couple of others. He's currently a co-director of the COCO Research Center on Collaboration or Collaborative Learning and Cognition. And he's also a deputy director of the Institute of Innovation in Science and Mathematics Education. And among many other things that I noticed in his biography, he was also visiting Munich recently. He was also a professional musician. And you can guess which instrument he played. Maybe he will tell us later on. So, I think you should tell much more about your personal perspective on that. Peter Reimann is a professor of education, also a co-director of the COCO Research Center. He had different stations, among others, universities in Germany, Heidelberg. He has been to the Learning Research and Development Center, LRDC, in Pittsburgh at a quite interesting time, I would say. And his main interest is about collaboration and cognition, with an emphasis on cognition. And I think he recently influenced the learning sciences quite much with bringing back the attention on the issue of time in collaboration and interaction. So maybe Peter and Michael, if you could introduce yourself a bit more, and then we jump into the topic.
Peter, should I go first? Or do you want to go first?
Yes, please. Go ahead.
Okay. My journey in the learning sciences, it's... you know, when I look back on it, you know, again, since there's, a master's and PhD students, when I got into this business back in 1986 at Illinois, there was no internet, there was certainly no World Wide Web, and there was no field of the learning sciences either. And I was kind of fortunate being at Illinois to watch the internet being born out of a lot of the computer science and engineering at Illinois, National Center for Supercomputing Applications, their work on virtual environments, but then the interest in sharing these high-performance computing resources really was one of the impetuses for getting resources to be able to share these more broadly. And then, of course, this led to the World Wide Web with the collaboration between Illinois and the CERN. So we had, for me, when I was doing my PhD, there were these interesting technical kind of developments. Rand Spiro was my supervisor at Illinois, a cognitive psychologist specialized in reading who got interested in technology and what was called hypertext back then. Don't use that term very much these days. But I was able to kind of be around a number of the folks because of funded projects and conferences. Who really started to articulate things that really then became, came to be called the field of the learning sciences. My first paper that I presented based on my PhD research after receiving my PhD was in fact at the first learning sciences conference at Northwestern University. And I guess I can really say that for me as a field, professionally, it's been a very interesting one. I'm glad it got vetted because it is a lot of the ways that I think about things. I do have an eclectic background. Sometimes I feel like a dilettante. I have 2 degrees in music. I play the viola and the violin, and I dabble with other instruments, but those are my ones. I play chamber music and such a bit now as a hobby. I think that the music that I've done has helped keep me kind of interested in the kind of aesthetic sides of designing technology. So I do try to make the systems that I'm involved with designing have a nice quality. The work on virtual worlds that I've been doing more recently in Singapore where I helped set up the Learning Sciences Lab in 2005, and then since I came to Sydney in 2008. But I'm also really someone who's very committed to, as I'm doing my research, to being grounded in some theoretical perspectives. So I'm certainly not someone who's interested in just doing the technology for the sake of it. The interest in complex systems kind of emerged, which is a word we'll talk a lot about, I think, today. In the 1990s, I was kind of looking for something that would be hard for people to learn, and I became exposed to some of this stuff, the Santa Fe Institute, some of the work that Rory Wilensky had been doing, and as well as other scientists, Stu Kaufman and so on, John Holland. And I thought, hey, you know, if we could get kids to learn some of this stuff, we could probably get them to learn anything. So I got interested in it as an area to help people learn about, and then to both for the technology environments and for the learning theories and such I was working on. It's gratifying to see interest more broadly in complex systems now. We're seeing complex systems being explicitly prioritized in the next generation science standards in the United States. We're seeing the National Science Foundation, the U.S. specifically funding projects on learning about complex systems in biology, a project with Eric Klopfer at MIT and Susan Yoon at University of Pennsylvania, for example. So appreciate the opportunity here with the Naples webinar to speak a little bit about some of the complexity things. Peter?
Can you hear me? Yeah. Yes, I'm from, sending or sitting in the Netherlands. And sharing the same time zone with folks in Munich and I guess most parts of Europe, which is pretty late. Good thing the first soccer game just ended, and it kept me awake up till now. Very shortly, my trajectory to the learning sciences has basically been fairly, I guess, conventional route. I'm a psychologist by training, a cognitive psychologist by training, and spent some time also in Pittsburgh at the heyday of artificial intelligence, when Newell and Simon were alive and kicking, and John Anderson was younger than he is today. Cognitive modeling has been, in addition to statistics, the main method I've been trained in to apply to understand psychological phenomena and learning phenomena in particular. And I guess since the 80s, at least in psychology, educational psychology, and in learning sciences itself, modeling has not been applied much, much less so than we would have predicted likely in the 70s and 80s. That's also my interest, I guess, in complexity theory. That's why I team up with Michael, who is much more the expert in this than I am. My main interest in complexity theory and its application to learning phenomena has to do with the modeling aspect, I guess. And I'm as so many, quite fascinated by the notion of emergence. I guess my take is still mainly methodological. And so my part today will also be more on a short piece, more on the method side of how to do modeling when one wants to explain phenomena with complexity concepts. I guess that's enough, and I guess I will be learning as much as most of you from Michael about the general concepts. Back to you, Michael. I'll come in later. Apologies, my laptop. I'm doing this from my laptop to not keep my wife awake. My office is adjacent to the master, to the bedroom. So I'm doing this from our living room with my laptop, and my laptop doesn't recognize, my camera isn't recognized by the Adobe player. So I know no image for me. But you'll hear me later. Back to you, Michael.
Okay, thank you, Peter. Let's see. Yeah, I took down the slides. I do have to mention one thing. If you're new to Adobe Connect, is we've made it so that everybody can use the video, and so it also means if you click on the little arrows, you're going to change the slides before I want to change them. So please don't be tempted to peek ahead. We will of course make the slides available to Frank, and I guess you post the slides on the website or something. All right. Well, let the talk begin. Since we mentioned Herbert Simon, and I'm really quite fond of this quote, because I think to me it encapsulates one of the real challenges that we have with understanding science, but also just the thinking about it, particularly in this new century. The task of a natural science is to make the wonderful commonplace, to show that complexity, correctly viewed, is only a mask for simplicity, to find pattern hidden in apparent chaos. That, when I first read it, back in the late 80s, really resonated with me. That was before I knew about the field of complexity and so on, even though Santa Fe Institute was set up in 1985 and people were hatching those kinds of things. And it brings up one kind of epistemic issue, which we may allude to a little bit more lately, is that things that appear complex and that have meet certain definitional requirements for being a complex system, actually viewed a different way can be viewed as interactions that often may be simple at particular levels of the system, and that kind of tension between simple things yielding complex behaviors, I think, is sometimes a challenging epistemic one for people. And I think that Herbert Simon really nailed it with this. What I'd like to do now is to have just a consideration of complexity, and maybe just a quick question: How many of you have used NetLogo as a modeling tool? Uri Wilensky's NetLogo at Northwestern University, or StarLogo? Yeah, they're evolutionarily joined at the hip. Okay, raise your hand. You can practice raising your hand, I guess, or people can type. Has anyone? Okay, not. All right. Well, I highly encourage. I know John would, because he took my class. So. okay. Well, that's interesting. I highly recommend that you download NetLogo, and it's free, and play around with it. So, Peter, maybe why don't we switch screen, and then we'll show you one of the NetLogo models that I think is quite an important one for our purposes here. Now, NetLogo is actually an agent-based modeling tool, environment. Uri Wilensky developed this. The history of NetLogo is kind of interesting. NetLogo was actually originally a program that ran on a Thinking Machines parallel processing supercomputer back in the 1980s. And Uri Wilensky, who had at that point 2 degrees in physics from MIT, worked for Thinking Machines. When he went to the MIT Media Lab to work with Papert, he was involved with doing a port. Mitchell Resnick, I think, was involved as well to port this program that ran on a supercomputer to as a parallel thing to run on a sequential machine. In this case, a Mac. Now, agent-based modeling tools, Peter will give a little bit more, but basically you model systems as elements or agents, and then there's rules that define how the elements or agents interact with each other. And so here Peter's showing you some of the background code, and you'll see that in most of these models in NetLogo, you can model some very sophisticated things with a relatively small amount of code. We have a model of the IPCC climate change data that runs with code that's maybe three times as long as this, but that's still it let you do global experiments. But that's another story. What I want to do here is have Peter run this little traffic jam. Basically, what you can see is the cars will speed up and slow down. And if they get too close to another car, they'll slow down. And if there's not, if there's space in front of them, they'll speed up. And then on the right side, it wraps around to the left side. Okay, so it's kind of like they're on a loop. And then there's a red car that lets you kind of focus in on things. So can you kind of see how the simple rules work? That they're speeding up and slowing down. That it's really that simple. What the rules are. You can control those sliders, and so you could vary how much they might deaccelerate or accelerate. You can vary the number of cars, but it's a very simple little model. Now, what do you notice as it's running about which way the cars go? Anyone? This is an obvious one. Cars, of course, go from left to right. But which way does the traffic jam go? In other words, the clump of cars that appears periodically. Which way does the traffic jam go? Think of that clump as a little traffic jam. Anyone?
It seems to be moving from the left.
I couldn't quite hear that. The traffic jam is moving
from the right to the left.
From the right to the left. Does everyone see that? Because not everybody does. But that's exactly it. The cars are going from the left to the right, but the clump propagates backwards, so it's going from the right to the left. Now, why is that important for us as scientists who study anything but scientists who study learning? Essentially, this is the simplest model that I know that I think really, really nicely captures one of the most important aspects of what the study of complex systems is about, and that is emergent properties. Essentially, that clump, that traffic jam, if you will, is an emergent property of the system. It's not in the rules that define the behavior at the micro level of the system. The emergence is because of the interactions. And what we're going to be really exploring in some of the things that will be asserted here, claimed, if you will, is this notion that learning is probably best viewed as an emergent phenomena, not as a thing per se. Kids got some stuff that's somewhere, and then they got to get it into the head of the kid. Something that emerges out of interactions, and so we'll be making some claims about what that means in terms of theory, what that means for methodologies. But first, I want to talk about kind of what it means for learning, because that's what most of us were doing initially. As we were, I was thinking about this as something to do, but basically I think I wanted to show the traffic jam thing, so I'll skip through that. That was my late night idea when I was finishing up the slides yesterday. Let me give you a few more example of complex systems things. One of the quintessential ones is the flocking that emerges out of birds. It was thought for a long time there had to be some kind of a leader bird and the other birds followed. Turns out that there's not. There just happens to be a bird. One bird's flying. Birds tend to want to stay close to each other. Birds of the feather stick together. But what happens if they get too close to each other? Well, their wings will hit and it's not so good. So birds will tend to go in the same direction. If they get too far apart, they can't see each other. But if they can see each other, they'll want to come together. So with those three rules, there's a famous algorithm called the Boyd's algorithm, this is a screenshot of that. In NetLogo, you can run a flocking algorithm as well, but that's often used as an example. But we also have examples of complex systems in terms of how our white blood cells adapt to different bacterial invaders, because new bacteria come in all the time, viruses too. How does our body respond? Well, there's ways in which, at that level of the physiology and the chemistry, adaptations go on that, fortunately for us, help keep us alive. complex systems, we can basically look at how the brain works. It's a pretty complex example of a complex system. But if you think about what happens at the level of neurons, neurons are very, very complex, if you will, in terms of their chemical properties and stuff, what goes on. But essentially, when the neuron fires, what's it do? It sends out a signal that will stimulate or inhibit another neuron. So it's complex at one level, at a micro level, but it's simple in terms of how it behaves and how it interacts with other neurons. And so that's a very interesting kind of thing. But out of those kind of simple interactions among neurons, of course, we have our emotions, we have our cognitive behaviors, we have the ways in which we can interact with the world, the ways in which animals and so on function as well. So clearly the brain is an example of a complex system. Anything with equilibrium, it's a complex system. There's wonderful in the model library in NetLogo, there's wonderful little models on most of these kind of, a lot of the standard science topics, such as predator-prey interactions, chemical equilibrium, and so on. We know from a lot of research in science that students really struggle with equilibrium. They just don't get that, at one level things are still cooking and everything, but at a micro level it looks like it's stopped. And it's a really tough thing to understand, but it is a characteristic of a complex system. The equilibrium at the macro level is an emergent property of the interactions at the micro level, in a similar kind of, similarly as we had with the emergence of a traffic jam just a minute ago. And interestingly, we can look at the application of these things in terms of social sciences as well. There's a very nice model, again, in the NetLogo library on that illustrates how that does a model of one of the famous theories of segregation and shows how segregated neighborhoods will emerge out of the choices that individuals would have in terms of who they might live with. But in this case, they're little agents, little dots, and so on. But you'll see segregation emerge out of those kind of interactions rather than being imposed by, say, some government restriction saying you have to live in a certain area or not. Now, clearly that happens in the real world, but you get segregated kinds of neighborhoods kind of organically is what research shows and what models like that will show as well. But again, human social systems as being examples of complex systems. So we have many examples. Okay, let's go to the next slide. So the classical view, if there is such a thing, again, as I mentioned, we have elements or agents. They interact with each other based on simple rules. We have feedback interactions. The feedback can be positive or negative. Often what makes complex systems interesting is the positive feedback aspects, where you set up cycles, amplification. But you have the feedback interactions going at a micro level of the system, and then once another level emerges out of the micro level, at a macro level, the properties of the macro level often can then feedback down to a micro, mezzo, or micro level of the system. And so oftentimes I would argue in science, and often in our own research, we tend to study things at one level. And we'll get to this a little bit later. We'll be looking at individual cognition, or we'll be looking at sociology and kind of social dynamics. Different levels of a system, I would argue, but typically they're studied at a particular level. With complex systems, we get a way to be able to think about multiple levels and interactions, and we'll be revisiting that notion in a bit. The notion of self-organization, there's a strong bias. Uri Walensky and Mitchell Resnick have pointed this out back in the 90s. That people really seem to like to see things determined. They want to see things controlled. If it's not controlled, it's going to fall apart. Chaos in the Greek sense. But complex systems actually do self-organize in some interesting and key ways, often because of the feedback interactions. But that's and again, we've been talking about the notion of emergent properties, a very key construct. and many would argue perhaps the most important construct to come out of the study of complex physical and social systems. I've been talking a bit. Does anyone want to ask a question or make a comment before we surge on? Okay. I do apologize for those of you who are very late at night. This is maybe a lot to go through. Why would we want to learn about complex systems in education? I'll go through this a bit quickly. It's these things come out of the paper that that I did with Ori Walensky in the Journal of the Learning Sciences in 2006 that we sent the Galley proof on. Essentially, what people would argue is that these are ideas that are really getting integrated into a lot of different areas and disciplines. So they're ideas that have relevance. Particularly in the 90s, we started to see interest in scientists, policymakers, even business folks. Citigroup would send folks to the Santa Fe Institute for seminars with Nobel laureate Marie Gell-Mann and such. But many would argue, and I've kind of echoed those things, not being a real complexity science, but that these ideas give us ways to think about events and phenomena in some new and different ways. We can think about multiple causality. We can think about the consequences of interactions in different ways than the kind of billiard ball notion of that we typically underlies. Kind of a more mechanistic view of how the world works. We can be thinking too in terms of issues about timescales and levels of system. Peter's work on time is very, very appropriate to this. Often we look at things in kind of small, relatively small time chunks, but to look at how things unfold over time, how there might be different patterns at different times of a phenomena, timescales in the order of centuries. We typically study in classroom stuff, hours and maybe some days. Issues of time and scale are very important. We get some tools in complexity research to help us with some of these things. It's been argued that things that often we had to simplify in the past because we simply didn't have tools for them, we now actually can study them. And so that's, again, another reason why complexity work is important. Mainstream education, why is it important? Well, this stuff hasn't really been taught to hardly anyone. I talked to a person who was a senior management person, vice president of a multinational company yesterday. He was talking about how he, in his professional work, he saw all sorts of bad mistakes coming out in terms of management of large-scale projects. And he said, and it's because people don't understand complex systems. And why is that? Because it's never taught. So even smart people out in the world aren't taught about these things, unless you're in kind of specialized programs that specifically study complexity. It's simply missed the mainstream education. This is one of the reasons why you're seeing policy changes in countries like the United States to specifically integrate complex systems ideas into the K-16 curriculum, and I think that's very exciting. We have a gap. So tools that are there, ways of thinking, are simply missed. People don't know about them. These have consequences, okay? They can have consequences such as the VP I mentioned in a minute, but for an informed citizenry, I would argue that some of the problems that we have as a globally with dealing with issues like climate change, because people simply do not understand complex systems. The policy people, by and large, don't, and the citizenry doesn't, and that is a real issue, which is one of the reasons why one of my projects has been learning about the scientific complexity on climate change. But that's another talk. But it's been pointed out, this was something, we had a seminar on complexity and learning. This was when I think Cindy Mello Silver, who's another prominent researcher in this area, and Cindy's spoken on Naples before. it was Jim Caput, I think, made the comment to a question for Roy P. was moderating this session. Jim Caput, who was quite active in this area before he passed away, mentioned that typically we have a 20 to 30 year gap between figuring out stuff in science and kind of getting it into the mainstream experiences, and that, you know, how can we shorten that gap was kind of the challenge that was put out. I'll say we have an irony. You know, we're doing a lot of pretty cool stuff with technology these days, whether we're doing game-like stuff, virtual computer models, fancy videos and animations, all sorts of cool stuff. And a lot of what we're teaching in science is 18th century and 19th century stuff. How can we shorten that gap to get some 21st century stuff into the curriculum? Is that. Now, time-wise, now, Frank, we're going 90 minutes. I think I'll do five. I'll be 5 minutes and done. And then Peter, is that good for you? Have your 15, 20 minutes? And then another 15, 20 minutes? Does that sound okay? I'll blast through some of this stuff a little quickly because you can read about it. Oh, I just went and lost my screen. Briefly, we've had enough research, I would say, that has been able to show that, of course, we know that regular science ideas are hard for students. A question in the late 90s when I got into this area and in the 2000s was, could kids at this age even learn it? You know, is it just stuff that's too hard, they can't do it? We now have a body of research that I think shows quite compellingly that yes, kids can learn these things. In the paper 2006, we summarized that, the paper with Uri. And there's a number of studies there that are very nice studies. With the second handbook of the learning sciences is coming out. We have a chapter now there on complex systems that Uri is taking the lead on. And we kind of update more recent research on learning about complex systems. I have a paper published in Instructional Science recently on some of my work there. So, but we do know that it's still hard in certain ways. You know, there's sort of a bias to thinking that things are imposed top-down rather than systems kind of things bubble up in terms of bottom-up explanations. There tends to be assumed that systems need to be controlled, that things are linear. A small action has a small effect. A big action has a big effect. But that a small action in a complex system could be amplified to have a big influence, that's very counterintuitive to people. And that, some of my research is suggesting, and I would say some other folks too, is one of the really difficult things to get students to understand. So that's something I'm interested in right now. And then also briefly, I think, you know, if you think about this, if you look at complex systems as an opportunity, I think it allows us to think about ways we can push our theories about learning, push our theories about how people learn. Dick Lesh pointed this out in the special issue we had when we kicked off the Learning About Complex Systems strand in the 2006 paper. Yeah, please don't click the arrows, please. As much as I know you want to look at all the exciting things I've written for you, if you click it, it messes up things for everybody else. So please don't go back or anything. Okay. Let's see. I think it also lets us, you know, some of our areas of interest in the field, conceptual change. Well, you know, changing your ideas about linear versus nonlinear. Good topic to explore those kinds of things. Issues about transfer, whether you like the word transfer or you like to recontextualize the new situation, whatever label you want to have for learning something and being able to use it in a new situation. Goldstone and Walensky have suggested that understanding complex system gives us a way to maybe think about what they've got, I would characterize as the holy grail of learning sciences research, to promote far across domain transfer. So that's an interesting conjecture. Again, a research opportunity in the field to explore some really fundamental issues. And then it also gives us a way to think about the learning at individual level and learning collectively. And this is something that we talk about in the ICLS paper. We'll revisit in a little bit. Carl Verreider and Marlene Scardamalli have also written about this as well. How is it that we have collective things about learning, you know, classroom dynamics, learning communities, and so on, and what's that relationship of the learning community to the individual learning? Very interesting issue. Very difficult to conceptualize it unless you have, I would argue, tools that let you think across these different levels of an individual and the interactions of individuals. So, again, I think we have some research opportunities and theoretical opportunities as well. Okay, and then opportunities for methodology, which is where Peter is going to take us now. I'm going to just click right through this. We go to Peter. So, Peter, you want to take it away in terms of the modeling?
You guys still hear me? Let me just bring in my slide that one sec. Just move it over here. Again, no clicking, please, because otherwise we get confused. Why is this not coming larger? What's the problem here?
Click full screen.
One second. Maybe that's it. Yeah. Okay, maybe that's better. You guys still hear me? Can see me? Full screen doesn't really do it. One sec. That's really more a question of this window. Here we go. The full screen for everybody, you can control if you want to see a larger the screen, the presentation screen and full screen by controlling that from your individual display. Let me get a little more space. Okay. I want to spend about 20 minutes or so after Michael has introduced a bit, motivated the need perhaps for cognitive, considering complexity concepts in the learning sciences as well, and we will do that. He will continue doing that a bit more specifically after my piece. I just want to look, give you an idea of the tools available and basically the methods in general available to our researchers to do the modeling, right? So my question will be a bit more on the how of doing the tools available as to model complex systems. Maybe start a bit more generally. Why would one want to model complex systems? Basically, there's sort of two motivations. One is one engineering one. If you want to control a complex system, and it starts with the house, the thermostat in a household. Then you need usually a model of that system because the real system tends to be too complex, certainly if it's a natural one like the weather or climate. So one motivator to model systems, complex ones, is to reduce complexity for the purpose of control and monitoring. And a second reason to model complex systems or phenomena that are produced by complex systems is to use models as a part of a core part of an explanation, those are the basic purposes. I guess for in the learning sciences, the second aspect to see models as part of the as a form of explaining learning phenomena is the more interesting one. Another general question: what kind of an explanation is a model? There's not enough time here in tonight or in this session to talk much about that. But just as a reminder or as a demarcation, the modeling we are talking about, as you will see and as you have seen already with the little net logo example we showed initially, is different from statistical models, right? So many of you, at least those from the social sciences, psychology, education, when they hear modeling, they usually think of a regression model or a structural equation model or such. But in complexity research, we use different kinds of modeling, concept of modeling. which is closer to a notion of abduction as an explanatory move. So we want to explain something by generating something, a model that can reproduce or generate the phenomenon under question. So that's closer to abductive explanations or to explanation by abductive reasoning than to a statistical modeling. Only a few other general concepts worth keeping in mind. Again, if this is too small for you, please, on your individual screen, you can go to full screen mode if you want to, for visibility purposes. It's useful to distinguish between representational notations for modeling, the kinds of language one can use to construct models. To distinguish those from the tools that one can use to build models, representational tools. I'll use my arrow here a little. And then distinguish these two from the models as an output of the modeling activity, that is, representational artifacts or models. And the notation and the artifacts stand to each other in a guidance or constraints relationship that is ideally the modeling notations help us to formulate models that are not trivially true, that obey certain constraints, and that is helpful also for model testing. I'll come back to this. This will be a bit of an organizer for the two modeling approaches I will show you next. And one last slide on general aspects. Again, of course, way too short, but you know, worth mentioning is model testing. How does one go about testing models of complex systems? Well, that's not a major surprise here. Basically, the logic is that you have your model, which is a model of an aspect of reality, and that model helps to the model, because it's generative, as I just mentioned, generates data, generates behavior. You've seen that in the NetLogo model as well. In principle, that model behavior can be compared to the real world as measured. And then the logic is, of course, to compare these two data bodies or data sets for differences. And then we have the general question that we can also use statistical tests of fitness then as for regression models, where we can ask, is the difference between the model behavior and between the measured behavior, is that close enough that we can see the model as having produced a serious explanation of the concept we're interested in from reality. So not a lot of surprises there, but worth mentioning that that's how models in general get tested. Any questions up to here or comments before I go on? Because next step I'll introduce two approaches to model complex systems. You're all good so far? Okay, moving on. Let me know for the chat or so if I'm talking too much. My microphone seems still, yeah, thanks Frank. I have a super sensitive microphone, which is too good. Too good a headset. Is this better? Okay, no complaints. Moving on. So we have two options currently to model complex systems, two sort of methodologies, along with a tool. It's still too loud. Okay, I'll try to speak a little bit less loudly. And the two approaches we have are system dynamics models and agent-based models. What you've seen in NetLogo, it's a typical agent-based modeling approach. So I want to focus also a little bit more on system dynamics models because they are also interesting and have a long history, more from engineering and more used to model for prediction and control purposes. So let me start with system dynamics modeling, probably familiar, at least basically, to all of you, because the notions of feedback learning and feedback relations have been around for a while in Kubernetes originally, which is the mother of these models. And basically, so a basic concept in system dynamics modeling approaches and thinking about complex systems is the feedback loop. And we, you know, have two principal feedback mechanisms. One is positive feedback. So the more of X, the more of Y, and then the more of Y, the more of X. So it's a reinforcing feedback mechanism or positive feedback. And the other important type of feedback is negative feedback or balancing feedback. So for instance, in populations are kept somewhat stable or within certain limits by the death rate agents in the population dying away, and so then usually we have a combination in complex systems of dynamic of positive and negative feedback loops, which in the end create something like dynamic equilibriums, and the curves that everyone sees are sort of going up and down within certain boundary values. So the equilibrium is static, is dynamic, which means that there may well be fluctuation, quite dramatic ones, but in natural systems at least, populations neither die away nor do they take over the planet, which would also mean they die away in the next time tick. Okay. I guess all of you, and particularly Michael, could you turn off the microphone? And actively mute it on the top, because I hear background noises. So at the top there's a microphone element which you can use, and you can mute your microphone. All right. So here now the basic notations. Again, here you may have to go to full screen mode to see that. So the basic notations now that come with system dynamics modeling. The animation didn't quite go through. No, that's bad. Okay, well, the basic elements we need. So there's something missing here that didn't make it in the automatic translation from the PowerPoint file to this Flash format on the server. Anyway, I guess what we need to know is we need sort of three things. We need stocks and flows to build system dynamics models. So ignore something that's here missing. I'll show it. It comes up in the next slide. Stocks are basically things that are accumulators. So anything that has a quantity and usually can be seen as a continuous quantity of just some stuff that basically can have more or less of stuff. And we don't care about the individual elements of that stuff. All we care about is if it gets more or less, right? So it's sort of a basic accumulator or container. And there's special other types of stocks or accumulators we can use for modeling, such as conveyors, which is a first in, first out type of logic. But that doesn't really have to concern us. A third type of stock is an open type of thing, type of stock, which opens and the in and out flow is sort of only happening at certain points in time, but then as a bulk, as it were. The other thing, so we need stocks or accumulators to do system dynamics models, and then we need something to change the accumulated stuff, which we do with flows. And flows are basically corresponding to the feedback loops, but we can distinguish uniflows, so something flows only in one direction from a source to a sink, and there are B-flows where the flow can go in both directions. Thirdly, we need something else like what's called converters, which are basically everything that parameters, initial values, that kind of thing is expressed in through converters. And finally, we need something like connectors. Connectors combine the various elements of a system dynamics model so that information flows, not only energy, but also information can flow between the components. So if we put these elements together, this is all we need. These are the modeling primitives. That's the modeling language, as it were. And then there are certain grammar rules, but I don't go into these. They are fairly simple. But here's what I wanted to also have in the middle of that slide just before. So here's a little system of a dynamic equilibrium. It models interest in subject and the subject matter. Let's say this would be a psychological model of students' interest. And this is a stock. These little things here annotate sources of indefinite capacity and sinks of indefinite capacity. That means we don't care what's happening here and here as long as something is happening. And that something is described by the flow description, which is a build-up, which is controlled by a build-up rate, and a dissipation, which is controlled by a dissipation rate. If you want to express this more concisely, you can just use two little equations. So the build-up is the interest times the build-up rate, and the dissipation is the interest, the stock size times the dissipation rate. So this would be a very simple, primitive, but syntactically correct model of interest in subject matter being being explained or modeled, so to speak. Anna is asking, how do you measure interest in subject, Peter? Well, that we have a quantity here. Over here does not necessarily mean that we have to measure it. As long as we can quantify it, that's all we need, so to speak. And only not all aspects of a model will necessarily be measured, but they all need to be quantified. And some aspects you definitely want to measure. For instance, if this was an important output variable or input variable, you probably would want to measure it. And in that case, we would use interest scales, I think, or physiological measures of interest. Anna, whatever comes to whatever you know you find, or from a research perspective or a practical perspective, comes in handy. But again, system dynamics models are not necessarily not everything in them needs to be measured and measurable, even as long as it can be quantified. And turns out everything can be quantified. Yeah, and as LMU is asking, it's essentially a way of making the differential equation, making calculus available to people that don't want to, they can't use that kind of mathematics. Formally, it's differential equations, of course. Yeah. Okay. And so then one built. So this is, this is a very simple model that uses all the notational elements, or at least one instance of the notational elements I've been introducing so far. And the syntactic rules are fairly straightforward. Of course, for each of these things, then each of these flow nodes, you have to specify the transformation in mathematical terms, which is needed to make the model runnable. So, how to do this now? What's the tool? What's a tool for doing for constructing such models? So, this was the notation. We move now to the tools. Which tools are out there to create models using this notational system? A very often used one, also in educational context, but also for professional researchers, is Stella. It's been around for quite some while. And Stella is basically a shell software, commercially you have to pay for it, that can be used to construct models and then run them, which means you can also then get output behavior and representations in tabular format, right? So that's the model, that's the typical output, and that's a typical tabular view of input and output variables. Using Stella or similar tools, there are quite a number of STM, system dynamics modeling tools around. One can then create fairly complex models of more or less complex phenomena, I guess. Now, I found one paper that gives a nice example of how to use system dynamics modeling to analyze a teaching learning situation. It's a paper from Eftekar and Strong, published in 1999. That's basically a Stella model of how two learning styles or two ways of learning, engineering in particular, affect various parameters such as interest, learning gains, and so forth. For those of you who are, you know, learning theorists or trained learning scientists, they may probably question some of the assumptions and the underlying concepts of learning. For modeling, as far as application of system dynamics modeling to a learning, interesting learning phenomenon is concerned, it's quite a nice paper. So I can recommend this paper if you want to really understand a bit more about system dynamics concepts, about Stella as a modeling tool, and how that's applied to a learning question. I won't go more into the underlying theory, which is, you know, I guess from my perspective at least a bit shaky, I'll just note and sort of illustrate with this example how you can use STM to model learning phenomena in terms of stocks and flows. And that would be a model for what they call in this paper a form-oriented learner. They make a distinction between form-oriented and function-oriented learners and how they react to teaching differently. They explain these differences by way of this model. One can also look at them just in terms of the notational system notations used. So these are the stocks, flows, and the differential equations, or the analog in summary. And then one gets output. One runs the model, as you've seen also with that logo, and gets similar sort of variable-oriented outputs. These, of course, would be usually measurable, because that's what we want to compare then with reality, and hence we need to compare it with something that's measurable on real learners or teachers. So, for instance, here I highlighted the interest development of interest over time based on teaching input as interpreted by a form-oriented learner in this case, which is part of the underlying theory of learning. That's a full round, I guess, of STM modeling. I just want to do the same, but a bit shorter. Well, before we do that, what's wrong with STM modeling? We should always be critical. It's more fun than being positive. So any suggestions what might be wrong, or what you find wrong with this approach as introduced so far? Through the chat, perhaps, then we can keep track of it. Anything you find fishy or inappropriate or such? I'll just wait a minute. I learned that one has to wait at least 5 seconds, which is twice as long as the usual teachers when they ask a question, because you have to type. Thanks, Anna. I think it's It's actually, there are quite a number of models of psychological phenomena, usually on motivation, which can be, I guess, sort of modeled with Dockson flows, you know, and Freudian psychodynamic concepts. No, I'll just wait for a couple of answers. There's nothing right or wrong here. It's more a question to you, what do you think is wrong, potentially wrong, with a SDM modeling approach. And don't worry, I'll do the same for agent-based modeling. Ah, it certainly is positivist. So Alamu mentions the need for precision, and we may not have a basis for that precision. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, and of course, whatever's not in the model can't be considered, and they potentially get lost. At least we have clarity what's in there, because that needs to be made explicit. One of the advantages of modeling is always its explicitness and where we draw the boundaries and all that. Yep. Okay. Good. Here are a couple of my answers to the question, in case you didn't answer. So here's one that Alamu also mentioned. Precise numbers and equations are necessary, although they will often not be known, right, or not so exactly. So we need to quantify, not necessarily to measure everything, but to quantify. And that just may not be a basis for that. Actually, no. So we may be able to quantify, but we don't know. More radically, maybe there are things in there in the reality that are not quantifiable but important. So qualitative differences matter. And SDM models are not really able to deal well with qualitative, different qualitative states. They all treat things as stuff that can shrink or grow. So there's a certain ontology assumptions behind it that certainly for human systems are not necessarily met. And, the individual cases are lost, right? You model the whole system all the time. There's not a single, the individuals that make up the system are not necessarily there. That's a particular problem if you think of modeling collective behaviors or multi-component behaviors, right? Which is the strength of agent-based modeling, to which I come next. I'll do this shorter because A, Michael will talk more about it, and B, we already showed an example. So agent, the notations you already have seen, right, in a sense. Agent-based models have an even more parsimonious notation. We have agents in their environment. This is a typical display here for an contagion or infection model, you know, who gets AIDS or some such, or another disease, tuberculosis. And how does that spread in a population? How does a disease spread in a population? That kind of thing. So to model this, we need agents, like people, and their environment. The environment is usually modeled as a two-dimensional space. So basically, we have adjacency or proximity as the main aspect that matters for environment. And the second element of the notation system, or the third, if you want, are rules. Right. The rules describe on a local level, that is on an agent level, how a single individual agent interacts with other agents and or information in the environment. So the rules describe agent-agent and agent-environment interactions. And they do this typically quite simply, right? So this is basically a rule that describes how the disease spreads in this model. And it's because it's formulated just in local rules for each of these little agents here, and they are all seen as basically similar in all aspects, other than having the disease or not. The rules tend to be quite simple, and if you can see it physically, visually, you can actually understand this. I think rule just by because it's simple and fairly like reads like a sentence almost, right? And you see here that the environment is sort of reduced to the distance to the adjacent agent. So if you to catch a virus in a plane or in a concert with lots of people around, that would be one of the ways to describe this. So that's the notation. That's sufficiently. That's refreshingly simple. And then we have the tool to build models out with the notational elements. You've seen one already, so I can skip over that. Just to show you again what you've seen basically some parameters one can set, then usually a visual display of the agents and their interactions amongst each other and the environment, and then you know the output behavior, the output variables, which are sort of quantities now plotted over time, and they sort of emerge and Michael will probably say a little bit more about that. These are sort of the emergent, the things that emerge at the system level, which are not programmed into these individual rules, but these system developments result from emergent phenomena caused by interactions of multiple agents following fairly simple rules. So in agent-based modeling, again, there are many tools around that you can use to do that if you would be inclined to do so. NetLogo is one of them, and it's particularly often used for in educational settings. And it's quite powerful. It's also used for professional researchers' work that want to model real systems using agent-based approaches. And again, ABMs, agent-based models for psychological phenomena. Such as actually a number of them in the model library and around in research, for instance, for altruism. Now, typically, ABMs are more used to model social psychology phenomena and group phenomena or mass phenomena, and less so for intra-psychological ones, because agent-based models are better suited to model multi-agent systems rather than individual agent systems. But of course, it depends on what the agent is. You can model a human as an agent-based system, or in its own right. So that's that, and then you know we've seen performance, so that's fine. So here, same question. This has been a bit shorter, but you got the idea. Get the idea, I guess. So what's wrong with agent-based models? We just have been bitching about system dynamics models, in a way. What's potentially wrong with agent-based models as a form of explanation for psychological, in particular, group and collective phenomena? Again, give you a minute. Okay, so there are three interesting points here. Natalie has one question that pertains to something before, difference between measuring and quantifying. I guess, as you know, just referring here to the way we use these words usually, you can quantify things, that is, hypothetically express them as a quantity without being able to measure them. There may be latent variables or latent factors, forces that cannot be observed, hence not measured, but that are still at work and hence have can be described in quantitative forms. So measurement is not a necessary requirement for quantification. Mauro thinks that agent-based models are not explaining emergent phenomena. Well, I guess they would. Michael will probably talk about more about that. What you see is these variable displays, these curves or graphs that would in principle be system-level behavior that emerges from local interactions. Different from system dynamics models, you don't have to program or specify these things explicitly in advance. LMU observes that all agents are modeled the same way. They usually are homogeneous, so that it's difficult to capture inter-individual differences. I think that's true in the sense that that's what we factually often see. In principle, you can have a whole variety of agents and variations of them that do express individual differences and see how that works out, plays out. I agree that's practically often not done. But it's not a principal limitation of agent-based systems. They can very well be used to also express individual differences, at least at some level of granularity. Again here, so thanks for that. All good points. Here my own points. One again, if you wouldn't have said anything, I had a fallback. Something that agent-based modeling is not so good at is what I find problematic from a practical point of view is that it lacks a graphical or otherwise comprehensive notation. So rules are nice, but you can have hundreds of rules and thousands of them, and then rules become as hard to understand, and their interactions become as hard to understand as any other with any other software or programming code. So there are limits to the understandability and hence transparency of models. In general, one could argue that agent-based models are fairly unconstrained because of the rules, and the rules are have Turing power. You can express with rules everything that can be computed in principle, which makes it a fairly big set of things that can be shown and produced. And so hence we are lacking guidance from the modeling notation, right? It's not so constrained. System dynamics models are much more, the notational system is much more constrained. Only four primitive elements and only two or three ways you can combine them. So on that score, SDMs are better if you want, because they contain more constraints and hence more guidance for the modeler. And then maybe I get a bit of a, you know, call it philosophical misgiving I have is the epistemic status of rules. Agent-based modeling literature, you often read that, you know, agents are implementing sort of a small set of simple rules. But of course, that's just a guess. It may be just the researcher or the modeler or the observer's rules, not the agent's rules. We don't know about them and cannot know, I guess. So that's a bit of an issue there that we have to be careful what we project onto our agents that we want to understand. And if it's just a researcher's opinion or guess, then that's fine, but it needs to be clear. Okay. So I guess you see where I'm driving at. In some aspects, SDM and system dynamics modeling approaches and agent-based modeling approaches are sort of synergistic. They sort of compensate for each other's weaknesses, and there may well be a next wave of modeling tools for complex systems that combines the strengths of the two and compensates for some of their weaknesses. Or we do it mathematically and get rid of it. So just, you know, to show you what I mean with the lack of graphical notations, system dynamics models are nice, but they are not. But we have to add modeling notations to make that happen. Okay, that's basically what I wanted to show in terms of the two approaches to modeling. Took a bit longer than I thought. Back to you, Michael.
Okay, so. Hi everyone, welcome back. Do want to do a time check. So Frank, what time do you want to have us finish up? I know it's particularly late where you are.
So can you hear me? I muted my microphone before, so I think we should, well, in 10 to 15 minutes would be good.
Okay, very good. Yeah, just one other comment to Peter's for what he covered, a quick introduction to a very complex area, which is the modeling. There's the use of the models in professional senses, which is what I think Peter was focusing on. And indeed, in a lot of scientific work, there's extensive use of system dynamic models, which are sometimes also called equation-based models. But in terms of thinking about the use of the models to learn, I think we have a really clear issue of not just that these approaches compensate with each other, but that you might very well be able to argue that there's particular disadvantages to one versus the other in terms of the initial learning about the phenomena. And by that, what I mean is, if you need to understand differential equations in order to create a system dynamics model that's based on differential equations, well, that gives you a teeny tiny sliver of the population that's going to possibly really going to be able to use those models to learn. Also, if you think about a mathematical formalism, like say we use the example of the population growth and death, it's talking about things on average that Peter talked about, but the equation is an equation. The phenomena itself, people living and breeding and dying and stuff, it's what I call kind of a non-orthogonal relationship between the behavior of the representation, in this case an equation, and the phenomena you're interested in. Whereas if you make an agent-based model of things, you could have sheep, you know, the classic tragedy of the commons kind of thing. You see the little sheep moving around on the screen, and then you can, see them eat some grass, or they don't have any grass, and then you see the sheep die. In other words, you can make representations with an agent-based model that have they're somewhat orthogonal in the representation to the behavior of the phenomena that you're trying to model. And then, as you can see, you actually can then get graphical output and so on. So for learning purposes, I think one could make the claim, and actually Peter had one of his students, Kate Thompson, do some research on this, that one might perhaps learn better with an agent-based model first. But particularly if you're interested in more advanced kind of scientific or engineering understanding and so on, at some point, too, you do need to then also go on to learn about the system dynamic models. Again, NetLogo is wonderful. You can get some nice models that are system dynamics models programmed in NetLogo, but the way that they run are as system dynamics models. And then you can get an identical model that's the agent-based model. So there's a wolf-sheep predation model, which there's an agent-based model version and the system dynamics version. And so I think if you're interested in some of these points that Peter was talking about, you can use NetLogo to explore some of those. And it's very important, very interesting. So there's a lot more that can be said there, but we'll go on. Given the issue of time, I'll just put the question out, but I don't think we really have time to discuss. How could this stuff actually help us in learning sciences research? I mean, we've been talking at sort of high levels of abstraction, advantages and disadvantages of different modeling approaches that's used for learning, but how does it really help us in the learning sciences? The paper that the second paper that we asked you to have a look at, which we'll be presenting at the ICLS conference in Boulder. And then there's some earlier kind of versions of some of these ideas out as well. What was a crack that we were taking at taking complexity ideas and seeing how they might be of specific relevance, how they might help us understand or deal with some things in the field that currently have not been dealt with. And so we'll use this as kind of a research case study, perhaps, to think about. What we do in the papers argue that we have some long-running debates in the field, fault lines, if you will. And so examples, the cognitive situative debate that goes back into the early 90s, CogSci Journal, and researcher. And I think we might be getting into the neuroscience kind of area too. So we've got debates about what's the best, what's the most appropriate way to be looking at things. We also have methodology wars, quantitative versus qualitative approaches. What Peter's been talking about, and which we deal with a little bit in the paper and with some other papers, a book chapter I've done with Manu, to argue that computational modeling should be put into a methodology that we use in the field, and that right now we haven't really been doing too much of that. Peter referred to work in the 80s where it was done in cognitive science and cognitive psychology, not so much in learning sciences, so those methodology wars. These are things that have been persisting for decades, okay? They are not being resolved, is essentially the argument in the paper. The field does not seem to reconcile or vindicate you know, a cognitive approach as being better than a sociocultural or situative, or vice versa. And essentially what you have is kind of, we ignore each other. We have different journals. Journals will publish things that will be using particular kinds of methodologies. They'll be taking primarily certain kinds of theoretical perspectives. Reviewers are often disinclined to be friendly to a paper that's in the other camp, if you will. And this is what we refer to as being silos that we have in the field. And again, we argue this is not a good thing for the field. We need to find ways to be able to move beyond these kinds of unreconcilable to this point kinds of debates. Another one might be knowledge in pieces versus coherent knowledge. But how might we get some kind of reconciliation? How can we can rise above, if you will, rapprochement? Now, since we really are out of time, and I think it's probably going to be beyond the capacity to go through this, I'll just kind of click through things because you can read through in the paper our summary about the situated debate. So on. I think there's a nice little summary of things, Sharon Derry. Actually, she had the same supervisor that I did, Ren Spiro, and I'm a big fan of Sharon's work, and of course, Steinhuler. See, some people just kind of taken some cognitive stuff, some sociocultural stuff that's sort of pragmatic. But Derry and Steinhuler point out that it really hasn't been principled about how this, you know, that these things are reconciled. It's just people are kind of ad hoc clobbering things together. They do speculate, though, in their 2003 article, that complexity theory might be a way to kind of reconcile things. In its broadest sense, it might be a way to, and also in terms of methodological approach, be superior to either theoretical viewpoint alone, okay, and then providing a more complete understanding of learning and education. In a way, this is really kind of where we are. What we argue in the paper is that maybe we can't quite make a complex systems theory, but we propose a meta theory. Now, what do we mean? A theory, and this is a section of the paper that Peter Ryman wrote, and I appreciate that. You know, theories are useful for specifying concepts and relationships that help us understand relationships in the world. Maybe one way to kind of distill what a theory is. In contrast, a meta-theory, as the meta implies, is a theory about theories. It's going to describe forms or a form that theories should take. It can identify requirements of what the theory should have and should try to achieve. That's a useful conceptual tool to have, if you will, a meta theory. We also point out in the paper that we don't really have a theory about complex systems right now. Essentially, what we have are what I would call a framework. There's conceptual perspectives, principal methods are being used in different areas: physics, chemistry, biology, climate. Lots of hyphenated sciences out there these days. But a lot of these concepts, emergence, sensitivity to initial conditions, use of different modeling, dynamic attractors, this and that, these kind of terms from complexity are being used in a wide range of areas. So what we argue in the paper is that basically the complex systems conceptual perspectives can help us generate a meta theory of complex systems meta theory of learning. And so at the core of this is just, and I'll really click through to wrap, gets back to the initial little net logo thing we had, that learning emerges out of these kinds of interactions in systems in which learning occurs, both formal and informal ones. And then from that, we break this out a bit more. I'll let you read those things. We do argue that there's ways in which this theory helps us reconcile the debate. There are three ways that we look at this in terms of levels of theoretical primacy, the methodologies being used, and kind of an epistemic one. The ICLS paper talks about the first and third I was hoping to talk about the second, but at this point, you know, we talked about differences in levels, referred to it earlier. The notion that the levels might be an individual level, a cognitive level, a neuroscience level, versus a different level, a more macro level of the system. And we argue that there's not really a principled reason to assume primacy of those levels, and there's more details of that in the paper. Whereas an advantage of a complex systems view, as we've alluded to earlier, is it lets us think in terms of across levels. We don't think in terms of trees in a forest. We think of forest trees as a way that it's referred. So I think I'm probably just best off, because we don't have much time. I'll just, because I like this little one, it'll take a minute to go through the drunk in the streetlight. You know, we have a person stops to see a drunk on his hands and knees underneath a streetlight saying, you know, what are you doing? And the drunk replies, I'm hunting for my glasses. But sir, they're not here. Where'd you lose them? Over in the dark alley, says the drunk, but I can only see here. Well, I like this metaphor for many reasons, and not just for this application, but I think in our research, we can see the streetlights as being our theories and our methodologies. And so cognitive and situated, knowledge and pieces, coherent knowledge, pick different kinds of debates. These become streetlights that we have that inform the kind of research that we're doing. That we argue in this paper that basically learning as emergence probably locates this phenomena, at least partly, in the dark alley. And so what we're hoping that we're talking about here a bit might stimulate some ways in which we could illuminate that dark alley in ways differently than perhaps we are now. We welcome conversations about these things. We do recognize that introducing some notions such as this probably generates an awful lot of questions and perhaps answers. But still, we welcome these questions in pursuit of hopefully right answers anyway. So with that, I will end. And I thank you for patience, particularly for those of you late at night in Europe.
Well, thanks, Michael and Peter. Are there any questions from you, from the audience?
So I would have a question, if you can hear me, I hope so at least. Can you hear me?
Yes.
So first of all, I think your work is very interesting because it solves the problem of the overgeneralization of linearity. And I just wanted to know if, well, it might be a bit of a mean question. So you're modeling psychological behavior, let's say, in some sense. Were you ever able to use your model to predict some behavior? I mean, you said, like, you make a model, you look at it, if it reflects reality, you work on your model, and so on. But have you ever had the situation where you could really predict something? Is it, like, already on that stage, your research?
Well, Peter, do you want to take a crack? I have a couple thoughts, too.
I'm not myself practicing that kind of models, but from the cognitive modeling approach in general, like production system models and so forth, I guess the predictions we do are probably of the same kind than we have with regression models or so. So we're never really predicting anything in the future. We are predicting data sets or behaviors or that can be measured as data sets that has, in a sense, already been measured. In that sense, we are predicting, these kind of models are as predictive as others. I guess the main difference is that a prediction is not necessarily seen as necessary to have a high quality model. If the explanatory power is in principle more interesting than their predictive value, as long as you don't want to use them for practical purposes, such as controlling systems. But if you ask, and that is indeed, I guess, what you mean with the mean aspect, and I would fully subscribe to being critical about that. If you're asking, has with these approaches anything been found so far that was really then in the future found as being true and having been predicted by the model itself? I don't know of an example of that, I must honestly say. But I'm pretty sure in the natural sciences, the situation looks somewhat better.
To that, because I think that's, it's not a mean question. It's a great question. The point that we make up front is our field has not done this hardly at all. I mean, there's some modeling that some of Uri Volensky's students have done, some agent-based modeling of classroom behaviors. One of the students' bureau has been doing policy things. We're very early days. But if we look at other areas of science, the Los Alamos labs, which sadly gave us the atomic bomb ages ago, had a very large contract to basically create an agent-based model of traffic behavior in the city of Dallas and in Seattle. So these were massive, massive agent-based models. And I attended a talk at the International Conference of Complex Systems. I'm an affiliate at the New England Complex Systems Institute, by the way. And someone who was involved with the Los Alamos modeling gave a very interesting talk saying, well, you know, we made this, we had all this data that they had about traffic stuff in Dallas. And so we made our agent-based model. And it accounted for things in the way that Peter showed. We could say the model behaved in waves according to the data that we had. So the engineers say, well, listen, we're looking to put a lane over in this place. So run your model and tell us what it says. So they put a lane there, in the model. And they say, you know, I hate to tell you guys, but if you put a lane there, it's actually going to kind of create some dynamics, turbulence, if you go backwards. It's going to slow up traffic flow, even though they got more lanes. And guess what the engineers said? That's nuts. You know, there's something wrong with your model. Well, guess what they did? They made the lane, and guess what happened? The traffic flow was slower, just as the model said. These models, if they're done with the right data and so on, be very powerful. A lot of the climate research that we're doing, models that predicted hurricanes in South America, people said, that's crazy. There's never been a hurricane in South. There's got to be something wrong with your model. Well, guess what? We've had hurricanes in South America because of climate change. So the models are perfectly capable. If you have the right kind of data. We've been showing little toy models, if you will, right here. But the potential of these things to getting insights that would give us sort of probabilistic understanding. So you got to give up, you know, the physicists gave up on, you know, Heisenberg uncertainty principle of, you know, really, you know, kind of clockwork accuracy on things. But probabilistic things, these models, I think, have the potential to give it to us in understanding social systems and understanding learning issues as well.
Thanks a lot to the two of you for the answer. I knew some of the physics examples, and that was exactly why I'm asking, because I know that those models are fairly strong in some domains, and like the whole international insurance system is based on these kinds of models, and just wanted to see how far they are already applied within learning sciences. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Well, see, these are great opportunities for you early career research people. You know, you could be doing things like this and really pushing the envelope. Going where few people have gone before is actually a good way to make some novel contributions. So encourage you to maybe think in the research that you're doing ways of adapting some appropriate modeling techniques as part of the data that you might be collecting. I think there's some real potential there.
Mm-hmm. So I think this already is also a part of an answer, or maybe the whole answer to my two questions. So one question is how is complex systems and dynamic modeling related to learning sciences? Why is that so important? And I think you pointed to in your presentation to at least two aspects. The one is that, of course, learners, science learners especially, but also others should learn or should be capable to deal with complex systems and should learn about the characteristics of complex systems. And the other aspect would be on a meta level to improve the theory building of the whole field in the learning sciences. And well, if we imagine the future of theory building in the learning sciences, also creating some models as you showed it, as you showed them today, I think that would that could really very much advance the field. Is there anything in addition that you want to say about the relation of complex systems modeling and the learning sciences?
Well, you know, I think, Frank, your comment there about the modeling and theory building is really spot on. There's some nice work. There's a great paper, I think. Piaget, Vygotsky, Got Game, I think, is the title. Dor Abrahamson and Uri Belensky did this paper a while back, and they basically created little agent-based models of, you know, Vygotskyan theory, if you will, and Piagetian theory, and you can get the model and kind of run it, and it's sort of interesting. And Jim Levin, who I worked with at Illinois, he was on my committee, came in and modified, got the code, of course, modified the model. They had an AERA presentation where it looked at ways in which, you know, he came up with a variation of the model that, again, had some interesting theoretical implications. Making theories runnable, I think, is actually something that we can do. Jim Levin and I have been doing some work on that. We presented a paper at AERA on some of that work. Not enough time here to talk about it. But I think there's some enormous opportunities to make the theories runnable, and then from that, look at the kind of data then you might get, and then, if necessary, revise the model as you might be elaborating the theory. So that's a different kind of way than taking the model and aligning to the real-world data, taking the model and aligning it to the conceptual thing, making a runnable theory, if you will. A different way of thinking about the use of models.
Yeah, thanks, Frank. I think the main contribution I can see at this stage is of agent-based modeling in particular is on getting a handle on the multiple levels of where learning takes place. So from the neuroscientific one all the way up to then learning on a social and even society level, and having a coherent set of concepts that sort of work across these borders and in a sense also help to understand where these levels come from can be a really important contribution also for the learning sciences. And I think just a bit more pragmatically, we hear a lot about the worries of learning sciences now and educational psychologists that their research and ideas are not used in schools by teachers and so forth. And again, in particular, agent-based models provide a nice basis to also theoretically shed some light on how innovation, how research, how new knowledge spreads or does not spread in a society. And or in a community or in a professional field, and I think there's a certain potential to gain a bit more theoretical understanding of what we currently consider fairly theoretically as research ideas, research knowledge being taken up or not, innovations of knowledge being taken up or not in the pedagogical and in the learning field. But I think there's more, and with agent-based modeling, we could really make a look also as this is a theoretical and a research challenge, and not only as a practical annoyance.
Okay, so I think that would also be a very good final word here in this webinar. I would like to thank our two presenters, Michael Jacobson and Peter Reimann, for this very interesting and inspiring presentation. I, meanwhile, rediscovered my Stella version on my computer here, and will try to convince some of the doctoral students to to try to use them with their work. So any final words on your side, Michael and Peter? And else, I think we close that webinar.
Well, I want to thank you for the opportunity to pull some of these ideas and so on together, and the opportunity to share them around the world and synchronously. So this has been very, very enjoyable for me, and I certainly hope that feel free, any of you, if you have some interest in some of these things, to contact me. I'll be at ICLS as well, so if you're going to be there, be at ICLS, I'd be happy to meet up with folks there in Boulder as well.
Yes, for me also, thanks for listening. I've never taught or gave a presentation between 12 and 2 really in the night, so that's a first. I admire the folks in Munich in particular who are hung around.
Yes,
I don't know
you
what
all.
You pay over there, Frank, but it must be substantial. Well, we've probably watched the soccer before. I guess what Michael and I think, and some couple of other folks who have been around for a while and sort of have a bit of a cognitive science, I guess, enculturation, it would be great if the learning sciences also could make a contribution to a modeling as a part of the research repertoire or the research tools that can help with the understanding of learning. And for me, it has always been a bit sad that with a move from cognitivism to situated cognition and to cultural historical theory and so forth, that we, in a sense, while that critique was all fair and good and brought us forward, we also lost in that move some of the strengths in the methodological realm, in particular regarding modeling. And I would love to see increased interest again in using models, not only statistical models, as a way to formulate theory and to test theory. Thanks.
Okay. Well, good night to those of you where it's night, and good day to those of you where it's day. And again, thanks a lot, Frank. Really appreciate this opportunity.
Thanks a lot for the webinar. Bye-bye from Munich and good night.
Okay, night-night. Yes, bye everyone. Thanks for joining us.